He was awake when she went in, lying in a shaft of smoky light. She knelt and held a cup of water under his mouth, tilting his head up so he could drink.
"It is the blue sickness,"
he said, when she let his head back down. "You're not going to die," she said. 90%. 90%.
"You must hear my confession."
No. He could not die. She would be left here all alone. She shook her head, unable to speak.
"Bless me, Father, for I have sinned,"
he began in Latin. He hadn't sinned. He had tended the sick, shriven the dying, buried the dead. It was God who should have to beg forgiveness.
"In thought, word, deed, and omission. I was angry with Lady Hermione. I shouted at Maisry."
He swallowed.
"I had carnal thought of a saint of the Lord."
Carnal thought?
"I humbly ask pardon of God and absolution of you, Father, if you think me worthy."
"There is nothing to forgive," she wanted to say. "Your sins are no sins." Carnal thought. "We held down Rosamond and barricaded the village against a harmless boy and buried a six-month-old baby. It is the end of the world. Surely you are to be allowed a few carnal thoughts." She raised her hand helplessly, unable to speak the words of absolution, but he did not seem to notice.
"Oh, my God," he said, "I am heartily sorry for having offended thee."
"Offended thee? You're the saint of the Lord," she wanted to tell him. "And where the hell is he? Why doesn't he come and save you?" There was no oil. She dipped her fingers in the bucket and made the sign of the cross over his eyes and ears, his nose and mouth, his hands that had held her hand when she was dying.
"Quid, quid, deliquiste," he said,
and she dipped her hand in the water again and marked the cross on the soles of his feet.
"Libera nos, quis somas, Domine,"
he prompted.
"Ab omnibus melis,"
Kivrin said.
"Praeterities, presentibus et futuris.
Deliver us, we beseech thee, O Lord, from all evils, past, present, and to come.
Perducat te ad vitam aeternam,"
he murmured, "and bring thee unto life everlasting." "Amen," Kivrin said, and leaned forward to catch the blood that came pouring out of him. He vomited the rest of the night and most of the next day, and then sank into unconsciousness in the afternoon, his breathing shallow and unsteady. Kivrin sat beside him, bathing his hot forehead.
"Don't die,"
she said, when his breathing caught and struggled on, more labored.
"Don't die,"
she said softly.
"What will I do without you? I will be all alone."
"You must not stay here," he said.
He opened his eyes a little. They were red and swollen.
"I thought you were asleep,"
she said regretfully. "I didn't mean to wake you."
"You must go again to heaven," he said, "and pray for my soul in purgatory, that my time there may be short."
Purgatory. As if God would make him suffer any longer than he was already. You will not need my prayers, she said.
You must return to that place whence you came, he said.
And his hand came up in a vague, drifting motion in front of his face, as if he were trying to ward off a blow. Kivrin caught his hand and held it, but gently, so as not to bruise the skin, and laid it against her cheek. You must return to that place whence you came. Would that I could, she thought. She wondered how long they had held the drop open before they gave up. 4 days? A week? Perhaps it was still open. Mr. Dunworthy wouldn't have let them close it while there was any hope at all. But there isn't, she thought. I'm not in 1320. I'm here, at the end of the world. I can't, she said. I don't know the way.
You must try to remember,
Roche said, freeing his hand and waving it.
Agnes, pass the fork.
He was delirious. Kivrin got up on her knees, afraid he might try to rise again.
Where you fell, he said,
putting his hand under the elbow of the waving arm to brace it, and Kivrin realized he was trying to point.
Pass the fork.
Past the fork. What is past the fork? She asked.
The place where first I found you when you fell from heaven,
he said, and let his arms fall. I thought that Garwin had found me.
Aye,
he said, as if he saw no contradiction in what she said.
I met him on the road while I was bringing you to the manor.
He had met Garwin on the road?
The place where Agnes fell,
he said, trying to help her remember.
The day we went for the holly.
Why didn't you tell me when we were there? Kivrin thought. But she knew that too. He had had his hands full with the donkey, which had balked at the top of the hill and refused to go any further. Because it saw me come through, she thought, and knew that he had stood over her in the glade, looking down at her, as she lay there with her arm over her face. I heard him, she thought. I saw his footprint.
You must return to that place. And thence again to heaven,
he said, and closed his eyes. He had seen her come through, had come and stood over her as she lay there with her eyes closed, had put her on his donkey when she was ill. And she had never guessed, not even when she saw him in the church, not even when Agnes told her he thought she was a saint. Because Garwin had told her he had found her. Garwin, who was like to boast, and who had wanted more than anything to impress Lady Eloise. I found you and brought you hence, he had told her, and perhaps he didn't even consider it to be a lie. The village priest was no one after all. And all the time when Rosamond was ill and Garwin had ridden off to Bath and the drop opened and then closed again forever, Roche had known where it was.
There is no need to wait for me, he said. No doubt they long for your return.
Hush, she said gently. Try to sleep. He sank into a troubled doze again, his hands still moving restlessly, trying to point and plucking at the coverings. He pushed the covers off and reached for his groin again. Poor man, Kivrin thought. He was not to be spared any indignities. She placed his hands back on his chest and covered him, but he pushed the covering down again and pulled the tail of his tunic up over his breeches, He grabbed for his groin and then shuddered and let go. And something in the movement made Kivrin think of Rosamond. She frowned. He had vomited blood. That, and the stage the epidemic had reached, had made her think he had the pneumonic plague, and she hadn't seen any buboes under his arms when she took his coat off. She pulled the tail of his robe aside, exposing his coarsely woven woolen hose. They were tight around his middle, and entangled with the tail of his alb. She would never be able to pull them off without lifting him, and there was so much wadded cloth she couldn't see anything. She laid her hand gently on his thigh, remembering how sensitive Rosamond's arm had been. He flinched, but did not waken, and she slid her hand to the inside and up, only just touching the cloth. It was hot. "Forgive me," she said, and slid her hand between his legs. He screamed and made a convulsive movement, his knees coming up sharply. But Kivrin had already jerked back out of the way, her hand over her mouth. The bubo was gigantic and red-hot to the touch. She should have lanced it hours ago. Roche had not awakened, even when he screamed. His face was mottled, and his breath came steadily, noisily. His spasmodic movement had sent his coverings flying again. She stopped and covered him. His knees came up, but less violently, and she pulled the coverings up around him and then took the last candle from the top of the rude screen, put it in the lantern, and lit it from one of St. Catherine's. "I'll be back in just a moment," she said, and went down the nave and out. The light outside made her blink, though it was nearly evening. The sky was overcast, but there was little wind, and it seemed warmer outside than in the church. She ran across the green, shielding the open part of the lantern with her hand. There was a sharp knife in the barn. She had used it to cut the rope when she was packing the wagon. She would have to sterilize it before she lanced the bubo. She had to open the swollen lymph node before it ruptured. When the buboes were in the groin, they were perilously close to the femoral artery. Even if Roche didn't bleed to death immediately when it ruptured, all that poison would go straight into his bloodstream. It should have been lanced hours ago. She ran between the barn and the empty pigsty and into the courtyard. The stable door stood open, and she could hear someone inside. Her heart jerked. "Who's there?" she said, holding the lantern up. The steward's cow was standing in one of the stalls, eating the spilled oats. It raised its head and lowed at Kivrin, and started toward her at a stumbling run. "I don't have time," Kivrin said. She snatched up the knife from where it lay on the tangle of ropes and ran out. The cow followed, lumbering awkwardly because of its overfull udder and mooing piteously. "Go away," Kivrin said, near tears. "I have to help him or he'll die." She looked at the knife. It was filthy. When she had found it in the kitchen, it had been dirty, and she had laid it down in the manure and dirt of the barn floor between times while she was cutting the ropes. She went over to the well and picked up the bucket. There was no more than an inch of water in the bottom, and it had a skim of ice on it. There was not enough to even cover the knife, and it would take forever to start a fire and bring it to a boil. There was no time for that. The bubo might already have ruptured. What she needed was alcohol, but they had used all the wine lancing the buboes and giving sacraments to all the dying. She thought of the bottle the clerk had had in Rosamond's bower. The cow shoved against her. "No," she said firmly, and pushed open the door of the manor house carrying the lantern. It was dark in the anteroom, but the sunlight streamed into the hall through narrow windows, making long, smoky, golden shafts that lit the cold hearth and the high table and the Wadmore sack of apples Kivrin had spilled out across it. The rats didn't run. They looked up at her when she came in, their small black ears twitching, and then went back to the apples. There were nearly a dozen of them on the table, and one sat on Agnes's three-legged stool, its delicate paws up to its face as if it were praying. She set down the lantern on the floor. "Get out," she said. The rats on the table didn't even look up. The one who was praying did, across its folded paws, a cold, appraising look, as if she were an intruder. "Get out of here," she shouted, and ran toward them. They still didn't run. Two of them moved behind the salt cellar, and one of them dropped the apple it was holding with a thunk onto the table. It rolled off the edge and onto the rush-strewn floor. Kieran raised her knife. "Get!" She brought it down on the table and the rats scattered. "Out!" She raised it again. She swept the apples off the table and onto the floor. They bounced and rolled onto the rushes. In its surprise or fright, the rat that had been on Agnes's stool ran straight toward Kivrin. "Of here!" She threw the knife at it, and it sprinted back under the stool and disappeared in the rushes. "Get out of here!" Kivrin said, and buried her face in her hands. "Moo," the cow said from the anteroom.
"It's a disease,"
Kivrin whispered shakily, her hands still over her mouth.
"Nobody's fault."
She went and retrieved the knife and the lantern. The cow had wedged itself halfway through the manor door and got stuck. It lowed at her piteously. She left it there and went up to the bower, ignoring the sounds of skittering above her. The room was icy cold. The linen that Eloise had fastened over the window had torn loose and was hanging by one corner. The bed hangings were down at one side, too, where the clerk had tried to pull himself up on them, and the flock mattress lay half off the bed. There were small sounds from under the bed, but she didn't try to see where they were coming from. The chest was still open, its carved lid propped against the foot of the bed, and the clerk's heavy purple cloak lay folded in it. The bottle of wine had rolled under the bed. Kivrin flung herself down on the floor and reached under the bed for it. It rolled away from her touch, and she had to crawl halfway under the bed before she could get hold of it. The stopper had come out, probably when she had kicked it under the bed. A little wine clung stickily to the mouth.
"No,"
she said hopelessly, and sat there for a long minute holding the empty bottle.
There wasn't any wine in the church. Roche had used it all for the last rites.
She suddenly remembered the bottle he had given her to use on Agnes's knee. She wriggled under the bed and swept her arm carefully along the bedboard, afraid of knocking it over. She couldn't remember how much had been in it, but she didn't think she'd used it all. She nearly knocked it over in spite of her carefulness and grabbed for the wide neck as it tilted. She backed out from under the bed and shook it gently. It was nearly half full. She stuck her knife in the waistband of her jerkin, tucked the bottle under her arm, grabbed up the clerk's cloak, and went downstairs. The rats were back, working on the apples. But this time, they ran when she started down the stone steps, and she did not try to see where they'd gone. The cow had worked over half of its body through the anteroom door and was now hopelessly blocking the way. Kivrin set everything down inside the screens, sweeping a space clear of rushes so she could stand the bottle upright on the stone floor, and pushed the cow back out, the cow lowing unhappily the whole time. Once out, it promptly tried to come back in to Kivrin.
"No," she said. "There's no time."
But she went back into the barn and up into the loft and threw down a forkful of hay. Then she scooped up everything and ran back to the church. Roche had lapsed into unconsciousness. His body had relaxed. His big legs sprawled out in front of him, wide apart, and his hands lay out at his sides, palms up. He looked like a man knocked out by a blow. His breathing was heavy and tremulous, as if he was shivering. Kivrin covered him with a heavy purple cloak. "I'm back, Roche," she said, and patted his outflung arm. But he didn't give any indication that he had heard. She took the guard off the lantern and used the flame to light all the candles. There were only three of Lady Hermione's candles left, all of them over half burned. She lit the rushlights too, and the fat tallow candle in the niche of the statue of St. Catherine, and moved them closer to Roche's legs, so she would be able to see. "I'm going to have to take your hose off," she said, folding back the coverlet. "I have to lance the bubo." She untied the ragged points on the hose, and he didn't flinch at her touch, but he moaned a little, and it sounded liquid. She pulled at the hose, trying to get them down over his hips, and then yanked at the legs, but they were too tight. She would have to cut them off. "I'm going to cut your hose off," she said, crawling back to where she'd left the knife and the bottle of wine. "I'll try not to cut you." She sniffed at the bottle and then took a little swig and choked. Good. It was old and full of alcohol. She poured it over the blade of the knife, wiped the edge on her leg, poured some more, careful to leave enough to pour over the wound when she had it opened.
"Beate,"
Roche murmured. His hand groped for his groin. "It's all right," Kivrin said. She took hold of one of the legs of his hose and split the wool. "I know it hurts now, but I'm going to lance the bubo." She pulled the rough fabric apart in both hands, and blessedly it tore, making a loud ripping sound. Roche's knees contracted. "No, no, leave your legs down," Kivrin said, trying to push on his knees. "I have to lance the bubo." She couldn't get them down. She left them for the moment and finished tearing the leg of his hose, reaching under his leg to split the rough cloth the rest of the way up, so she could see the bubo. It was twice as big as Rosamond's and completely black. It should have been lanced hours ago, days ago. "Roche, please put your legs down," she said, leaning on them with all her weight. "I have to open the plague boil." There was no response. She was not sure he could respond, that his muscles were not somehow contracting on their own, the way the clerks had, but she couldn't wait until the spasm, if that was what it was, had passed. It might rupture at any minute. She stepped away a minute, and then knelt down by his feet, and reached up under his folded legs, gripping the knife. Roche moaned, and she pulled the knife down a little, and then moved it forward slowly, carefully, till it touched the bubo. His kick caught her full in the ribs, sending her sprawling. She let go of the knife, and it skittered loudly across the stone floor. The kick had knocked the wind out of Kivrin, and she lay there, gasping for air, taking long, wheezing breaths. She tried to sit up. Pain stabbed at her right side, and she fell back, clutching at her ribs. Roche was still screaming, a long, impossible sound like a tortured animal. Kivrin rolled slowly onto her left side, holding her hand tightly against her ribs so she could see him. He rocked back and forth like a child, screaming all the while, his legs drawn up protectively to his chest. She could not see the bubo. Kivrin tried to raise herself, bracing her hand against the stone floor until she was half sitting, and then edging her hand toward her till she could put both hands down and get onto her knees. She cried out, little whimpering screams that were lost in Roche's. He must have broken some ribs. She spat on her hand, afraid of seeing blood. When she was finally on her knees, she sat back on her feet a minute, huddling against the pain. "I'm sorry," she whispered. "I didn't mean to hurt you." She half crawled toward him on her knees, using her right hand as a crutch. The effort made her breathe more deeply, and every breath stabbed into her side.
"It's all right, Roche,"
she whispered.
"I'm coming. I'm coming."
He pulled his legs up spasmodically at the sound of her voice, and she moved around to his side between him and the side wall, well out of his reach. When he kicked her, he had knocked over one of St. Catherine's candles, and it lay in a yellow puddle beside him, still burning. Kivrin set it upright and laid her hand on his shoulder.
"Roche," she said. "It's all right. I'm here now."
He stopped screaming.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, leaning over him.
"I didn't mean to hurt you. I was only trying to lance the bubo."
His knees pulled up even tighter than before. Kivrin picked up the red candle and held it above his naked backside. He could see the bubo, black and hard in the candle's light. She had not even pierced it. She raised the candle higher, trying to see where the knife had gone. It had clattered away in the direction of the tomb. She held the candle out in that direction, hoping to catch a glint of metal. She couldn't see anything. She started to stand up, moving carefully to guard against the pain, but halfway to her feet it caught at her, and she cried out and bent forward.
"What is it?"
Roche said. His eyes were open, and there was a little blood at the corner of his mouth. She wondered if he had bitten through his tongue when he was screaming.
"Have I done hurt to you?"
"No," she said, kneeling back down beside him. "No, you have done no hurt."
She blotted at his mouth with the sleeve of her jerkin.
"You must," he said,
and when he opened his mouth more blood leaked out. He swallowed.
"You must say the prayers for the dying."
"No," she said, "you will not die."
She wiped at his mouth again.
"But I must lance your bubo before it ruptures."
"Do not,"
he said, and she did not know whether he meant don't lance the bubo or don't leave. His teeth were gritted, and blood was leaking between them. She sank into a sitting position, careful not to cry out, and took his head into her lap.
"Requiem aeternum dona eis,"
he said, and made a gurgling sound.
"Et lux perpetua."
The blood was seeping from the roof of his mouth. She popped his head up higher, wadding the purple coverlid under it, wiping his mouth and chin with her jerkin. It was sodden with blood. She reached off to the side for his alb.
"Do not,"
he said.
"I won't," she said. "I'm right here."
"Pray for me,"
he said, and tried to bring his hands together on his chest. He choked on the word he was trying to say, and it ended in a gurgling sound.
"Requiem aeternum,"
Kivrin said. She folded her own hands.
"Requiem aeternum dona eis domine," she said.
"It looks,"
he said. The red candle beside Kivrin flickered out, and the church was filled with the sharp smell of smoke. She glanced round at the other candles. There was only one left, the last of Lady Hermione's wax candles, and it was burnt nearly down to the lip of its holder.
"Et lux perpetua,"
Kivrin said.
"Luceat eis,"
Roche said. He stopped and tried to lick his bloody lips. His tongue was swollen and stiff.
"Dies irae, dies
Elah.
He swallowed again and tried to close his eyes.
Don't put him through any more of this,
she whispered in English.
Please, it's not fair.
Beate.
She thought he said, and tried to think of the next line, but it didn't begin with blessed.
What?
She said, leaning over him.
In the last days,
he said, his voice blurred by his swollen tongue. She leaned closer.
I feared that God would forsake us utterly,
he said. And he has, she thought. She wiped at his mouth and chin with the tail of her jerkin.
He has.
But in his great mercy, he did not.
He swallowed again.
But sent his saint unto us.
He raised his head and coughed, and blood rushed out over both of them, saturating his chest and her knees. She wiped at it frantically, trying to stop it, trying to keep his head up, and she couldn't see through her tears to wipe the blood away. But I'm no use, she said, wiping at her tears.
Why do you weep? He said.
You saved my life,
she said, and her voice caught in a sob.
And I can't save yours.
All men must die,
Roche said,
and none, not even Christ, can save them.
I know,
she said. She cupped her hand under her face, trying to catch her tears. They collected on her hand and fell dripping onto Roche's neck.
Yet have you saved me,
he said, and his voice sounded clearer.
From fear.
He took a gurgling breath.
And unbelief.
She wiped at her tears with the back of her hand and took hold of Roche's hand. It felt cold and already stiff.
I am most blessed of all men to have you here with me,
he said, and closed his eyes. Kivrin shifted a little so her back was against the wall. It was dark outside, no light at all coming in through the narrow windows. Lady Hermione's candle sputtered and then flamed again. She moved Roche's head so it didn't push against her ribs. He groaned, and his hand jerked as if to free itself of hers. But she held on. The candle flickered into sudden brightness and left them in darkness. Transcript from the Doomsday Book. I don't think I'm going to make it back, Mr. Dunworthy. Roche told me where the drop is, but I've broken some ribs, I think, and all the horses are gone. I don't think I can get up on Roche's donkey without a saddle. I'm going to try to see to it that Miss Montoya finds this. Tell Mr. Latimer adjectival inflection was still prominent in 1348, and tell Mr. Gilchrist he was wrong. The statistics weren't exaggerated. Break. I don't want you to blame yourself for what happened. I know you would have come to get me if you could, but I couldn't have gone anyway. Not with Agnes ill. I wanted to come, and if I hadn't, they would have been all alone, and nobody would have ever known how frightened and brave and irreplaceable they were. Break. It's strange. When I couldn't find the drop and the plague came, you seemed so far away, I would not ever be able to find you again. But I know now that you were here all along, and that nothing, Not the Black Death, nor 700 years, nor death, nor things to come, nor any other creature could ever separate me from your caring and concern. It was with me every minute. Chapter 34. Colin! Dunworthy shouted, grabbing Colin's arm as he dived under the drape and into the net, head down. What in God's name do you think you're doing? Colin twisted free of his grasp. I don't think you should go alone. You can't just break through the net. This isn't a quarantine perimeter. What if the net had opened? You could have been killed. He took hold of Colin's arm again and started toward the console. Badri, hold the drop. Badri was not there. Dunworthy squinted nearsightedly at where the console had been. They were in a forest, surrounded by trees. There was snow on the ground, and the air sparkled with crystals. If you go alone, who'll take care of you? Colin said. What if you have a relapse? He looked past Dunworthy and his mouth fell open. Are we there? Dunworthy let go of Colin's arm and grabbed in his jerkin for his spectacles. Badri! He shouted. Open the drop! He put on his spectacles. They were covered with frost. He yanked them off again and scraped at the lenses. Badri! Where are we? Colin asked. Dunworthy hooked his spectacles over his ears and looked around at the trees. They were ancient, the ivy twining their trunks silver with frost. There was no sign of Kivrin. He had expected her to be here, which was ridiculous. They had already opened the drop and not found her, but he had hoped that when she realized where she was, she would come back to the drop and wait. But she wasn't here. And there was no sign she had ever been. The snow they were standing in was smooth and free of footprints. It was deep enough to hide any she might have left before it fell, but it wasn't deep enough to have hidden the smashed cart and the scattered boxes, and there was no sign of the Oxford Bath Road.
I don't know where we are, he said.
Well, I know it's not Oxford, Colin said, stamping through the snow. Because it's not raining. Dunworthy looked up through the trees at the pale, clear sky. If there had been the same amount of slippage as in Kivrin's drop, it would be mid-morning. Colin darted off through the snow toward a thicket of reddish willows.
Where are you going?
Dunworthy said. To find a road. The drop's supposed to be near a road, isn't it? He plunged into the thicket and disappeared.
Colin!
He shouted, starting after him.
Come back here!
Here it is! Colin called from somewhere beyond the willows. The road's here!
Come back here! Dunworthy shouted.
Colin reappeared, holding the willows apart.
Come here!
He said more calmly. It goes up a hill, he said, squeezing through the willows into the clearing. We can climb it and see where we are. He was already wet, his brown coat covered with snow from the willows, and he looked wary, braced for bad news.
You're sending me back, aren't you? I must, Dunworthy said.
But his heart sank at the prospect. Badri would not have the drop open for at least 2 hours, and he was not certain how long it would stay open. He didn't have 2 hours to spare. Waiting here to send Colin through. And he couldn't leave him behind.
You're my responsibility.
And you're mine, Colin said stubbornly. Great Aunt Mary told me to take care of you. What if you have a relapse?
You don't understand. The Black Death.
It's all right, really. I've had the streptomycin and all that. I made William have his nurse give them to me. You can't send me back now. The drop isn't open, and it's too cold to just stay here and wait for an hour. If we go look for Kivrin now, we might have found her by then.
He was right about their not being able to remain here. The cold was already seeping through the outlandish Victorian cape. and Colin's burlap coat was even less protection than his old jacket, and as wet.
"We'll go to the top of the hill," he said. "But first we must mark the clearing so we can find it again. And you can't go running off like that. I want you in sight at all times. I don't have time to go looking for you as well."
"I won't get lost," Colin said, rummaging in his pack. He held up a flat rectangle. "I brought a locator. It's already set to home in on the clearing." He held the willows apart for Dunworthy, and they went out to the road. It was scarcely a cow path and was covered with snow, unmarked, except by the tracks of squirrels and a dog, or possibly a wolf. Colin walked obediently at Dunworthy's side till they were halfway up the hill and then couldn't restrain himself and took off running. Dunworthy trudged after him, fighting the tightness already in his chest. The trees stopped halfway up the hill, and the wind began where they left off. It was bitingly cold.
"I can see the village," Colin shouted down to him.
He came up beside Colin. The wind was worse here, cutting straight through the cape, lining or no lining, and pushing long streamers of cloud across the pale sky. Far off to the south, a plume of smoke climbed straight into the sky and then, caught by the wind, veered off sharply to the east.
"See?" Colin said, pointing.
This ends side 2 of cassette 17 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 18.